Subs.
Abo.
Hey, you feel me, dog? You feel me?
I think he's hinting at something, pal.
Across Mother Earth, KGRA Radio.
All right, we're live, Micah.
Out on Z.
Is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from Skeleton Studios down here in Weatherford, Texas, I am truly the mouth of the South tonight, and you are live, locked in, ready and raring for a journey into the esoteric. It is the Grailian Report. This is the closest to being above ground I think I've done for a live program in quite a while, and to join me on this little evening foray is the one and only co-host of Expanded Perspectives, Mr. Cam Hale, sitting across from me right there. How you doing, big brother?
I'm doing great, sir. Thanks.
Great to have you here live with us tonight. We also got Kyle Filson lurking around the studio someplace, being the family man tonight. He's waving. Yeah. He's waving. Oh, somebody give him a microphone. Hey, you know what? We'll be hearing from you a little later tonight, and we're going to be talking about some of the latest travel, research, and adventuring we've been doing. We had the Paramania unevent down here this weekend, but it was anything but uneventful. We'll be talking about that in hour two. And, of course, also the latest breaking news in the unusual, in science, exploration of this universe, technology, artificial intelligence, and, of course, the esoteric. Glad, as always, to be your light in the darkness, although I'm not feeling quite so dark tonight. Oh, yeah. No matter where I go in the world, I can't get rid of him. I just can't shake that feeling, the feeling that haunts me like a bad dream. Mr. Race Hobbs back at Master Control in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Good evening to you, Hobbo.
Good evening, Micah. Good evening, Cam. It's a pleasure to have you along for the ride tonight.
Thank you so much, brother. Thank you so much.
You know something else, that especially when I come down here to Texas, Cam, something that is always something I look forward to getting down here. Usually the first night I arrive, after a long day of travel, I get here, and Guinness in the glass is not the only thing that's dark. The other thing that we always have to look forward to is the night sky. And
yeah,
there's a reason why they talk about, you know, the stars at night are big and bright deep in the heart of Texas. Here we are in Weatherford, and you can look up at the sky, and yeah, you see so much. Did you know it's International Dark Sky Week?
No, I did not.
Yeah.
I knew it was Hug a News Broadcaster Day. I knew it was something along those lines.
That's too bad there's a table between us.
I know, right? Man, I could use a good hug.
Yeah, you'll get one later.
All right, I'm down.
Exactly. Somebody get this man a pillow.
That's right.
Yeah, apparently from April 4th until April 10th, you can get an opportunity to catch a perfect view of the night sky. And the reason why is because several state parks are actually going to be remaining open for stargazers and enthusiasts, but they're also encouraging people to turn out a lot of the ambient lighting, mm-hmm. which prevents one from being able to see the night sky. That's something that always strikes me, living up in Asheville. I'll come down to a big city, and of course, you know, this past weekend with the Paramania thing, I was over in Dallas, but you'll look up and you'll not see the stars, and I'm so used to seeing the stars, it was almost unusual for me to be in Dallas driving around and looking up at night, and I could spot Jupiter, you know, and I could see Sirius, and I could make out the Big Dipper, but, you know, the Pleiades, you know, or something mm-hmm. like that, you know, virtually invisible with all the ambient light.
It's slightly depressing when you're in a big city like that at night, which is funny like that.
You were talking, by the way, the other day about some location around here where you said, I mean, it's just the most pristine viewing mm-hmm. at night. What was that?
We used to have some land we used to run around on out in Seymour, which is out in northwest Texas from here. And it's about three and a half hours from here. And we're talking about being out in the middle of nowhere. We're on 4,000 acres. There's no light. There's no houses. There's no anything. And it's all surrounded by other big ranches and fields. And you can get out there. And there's literally nothing. It's the same as when you go down into southwest Texas. You start heading back in down in that area off Interstate 10. Mm-hmm. You can get back in down by, say, Ozona and Sonora. And you can get back over there. There's nothing out there. So when you're looking up, you're looking as pretty much as clear as it's going to be anywhere. And I'm sure there's other areas it's maybe, but there's no there's no industry around there for it to have any kind of haze in the sky. There's nothing, literally nothing but desert. I mean, it's just like we talked about at dinner the other night, being on the King Ranch.
Uh-huh.
There's huge areas on the map at night that you look in Texas, it's total darkness. It's because that giant ranch, there's nothing on it. There's no power. There's a handful of homes scattered in certain areas on it. That's it.
See
so
that,
you, when you look up, you're seeing everything. That's it. I mean, there's no light pollution, period.
That just fascinates me. And see, the whole thing about this International Dark Sky Week, there was this documentary that was made a while back called City of Night. And what's interesting about this documentary is it asks the question, hey, what are we doing to ourselves by having on light at night? We all know that, you know, if you sit in front of a television or a computer monitor late at night, it can actually alter the production of melatonin in your body, which, of course, you know, is I guess we have evolved for this to be concomitant with the presence of light and darkness. And, of course, back in ancient times, we never had a problem being able to be in darkness at night, even with the advent of fire. But now with all of the artificial light sources in the modern world, many ask, what are we actually doing to ourselves with the elimination of darkness altogether? So this event was first created back in 2003 by a student named Jennifer Barlow. And they have a website for International Dark Sky Week, but I would just recommend just Googling that term. You can find it. Barlow had said on the site, I want people to be able to see the wonder of the night sky without the effects of light pollution. The universe is our view into our past and our own vision into the future, and I want to help preserve its wonder. But they look at some of the problems that light pollution can cause, the advocates' measures and solutions that can help minimize it. They say that the nighttime environment is a crucial natural resource for all life on Earth, but the glow of uncontrolled outdoor lighting has hidden the stars, radically changing the nighttime environment. Also says, we are only just beginning to understand the negative repercussions of losing this natural resource. A growing body of research suggests that the loss of the natural nighttime environment is causing serious harm to human health and the environment. Now it's funny because I bring this up because on this program, we so often do talk about the way that your sleep cycle can be offset by various things and the kinds of things that people experience in between sleep. You know, we talk about that second sleep, the spur of creativity that can occur in the middle of the night, you know, when you're awake and you can't go back to sleep. I've had so many people write in the last few months talking about this. So this week is actually aimed at kind of trying to understand the way that technology once again is changing our lives and changing the way that we, you know, even the way that we function in terms of our circadian rhythm. And so I find that stuff extremely fascinating, and I can't help but wonder sometimes, although, you know, back in the old days, yeah, people did describe this second sleep, as we've discussed. So I wonder sometimes if the whole idea of imposing a good night's rest and not waking up in the middle of the night is in equal measure a kind of a disturbance to what is natural and what has always been natural to us as the artificial kind of light sources.
It's funny that you bring up with the artificial light. We had an issue where I work in some of the water purification areas with the way lighting was affecting certain, we had some certain vinyl lines and things that were just from test water, but it was causing algae growth. But because of the lighting that we had seen. So I kind of got off on a tangent. This has been a couple of years ago. This has been a while back.
Yeah.
And I got to read it. And there's actually a book that I had found that I haven't gotten to read. I've read excerpts from it. It's written by a man named John Ott. And the name of the book is Health and Light. And what was interesting about that is because John Ott was actually a time-lapse photographer for Walt Disney.
Oh, really?
And he got big into trying to show the impact of artificial light on the human body, talking about tumors on mice, talking about how that would throw their offspring, where you could have male from one light or female from another light, how it was affecting mice. And from that point, and we're talking, this is back in the 50s when he started this. And what's funny is it's not super well known, which is crazy to me because I'm like, look, you're talking about 60 years ago and now they're not, you know, we're not going to discuss any of it at all because we know the impact of it. There's a lot of problems with it that you'd be surprised of how much the human body needs real sunlight.
Yeah.
And it's, we just, you take it like you're talking about eye strain. They've linked the, not just the light from a computer screen, but the close distance of the stare to eye weakness. If all you're concentrating on is something within 2 feet, you need to practice long distance viewing. Mm. You need to stand for a certain amount of time every day and look at the horizon, focus on trees, focus on something to try to zone in on, even if it's 1,000 yards away, because the human eye was built to be a hunter-gatherer device. You gather up close, you hunt out far, you use your eyesight. different distances. We are to a society now where everything's within 2 foot of us. Our phone, the end of our arms, our TV screens are right here in the same room, our computer screens we sit in front of. And if you notice now, what do you think, that everybody had horrible eyesight? No, that's slowly started to develop now as we go, as it's bred along, almost like an evolutionary change, in my opinion, of course, being that I'm a doctor and all. Anyhow.
Wait, I actually am.
Hold on. Yeah.
Well, of sorts.
But it's funny that all this stuff links together, and it's little things that we pass off. But like you were talking about, the circadian rhythm that we have, it also messes not only with your melatonin, it can mess with your serotonin, which is what you create for happiness. So these are certain things that you need to look into, that if you're having problems, folks, the first thing I would tell you to look into is the lighting around where you work, as well as the lighting around your home when you come home, certain lights. Here's another thing. You know why people, in my, what I always thought is, you know how much fun it is when everybody lights candles around their house?
I love that, yeah.
You know why? Because it's natural light.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. It's the warmth of a fireplace. I've always raised my children. I call it the woodland TV, the wilderness television. When you have a fire, why is everybody drawn to stare at it?
Huh.
You're trained to put your back to the fire and look into the darkness so it doesn't affect your night vision. Mm. That's what you're trained to do, but you can't. You're always drawn to that flame.
Well, there is something entrancing.
Yes, it's something because it's the warmth. It's in your genetics to be drawn to that fire because that fire is your safety. But it's a natural light. So just think about that now whenever you're sitting underneath these crappy blue humming bars of death above your table. Yeah. You always heard me turn that on. The ballast isn't working and you're swimming.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's also, I think, you know, the electromagnetic component. I remember I went to, there had been a couple a number of years ago. And I've talked about this. And in Magic Mysticism of the Molecule, it's actually mentioned in the back of that book. But this couple had been having all these strange things happen. And one of the things that the woman had said that she had experienced was the apparent presence of, I don't know what she might have likened it to, apart from just voices that she perceived. But she said they weren't voices. She said it was more like a presence, but there was definitely something trying to communicate with me. And she said it would always be when I would go out in the mornings and I'd be standing out on the porch on a particular side of my house. Now, it turns out she suffered from a variety of electrical hypersensitivity and multiple allergy. Okay. And
that's a mouthful.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is interesting because when you dig into the UFO lore, there's actually a bit about UFO and contactee and UFO observations and also humanoid encounters and all kinds of strange kind of alien encounters as it relates to multiple allergy and kind of electrical hypersensitivities that manifest. And I mean, one way that these tend to manifest is especially people who have had some sort of an intense electrical shock, some sort of an accident or incident that involved an electrical shock earlier in their life.
Mm-hmm.
It can, I don't know if it's a metabolic pathway that is opened or what, but these people can tend to have a hypersensitivity to the actual proximity that they share with electrical fields. So this woman had told me that on one side of their house, they had no electrical appliances because if there were any devices, any radios, any microwave ovens, any, lighting, especially, not UV lighting.
Like fluorescent lighting.
Yeah, fluorescent lighting. Yeah, exactly. Anything like that in her home, she said it prevented her from being able to sleep at night. That's how bad the disturbance was. Now, I asked her, I said, now, which side of your house is the porch located in which you experience these odd presences? And she says, well, that's just on the other side of my kitchen. I asked, I mean, presuming that they're, as most kitchens would have, unless they cook entirely by fire or wood oven or something like that. I said, you know, do you have appliances in your kitchen? She said, yeah, that's the side of the house where we have our appliances. And it reminded me of this story that Paul Devereaux and a number of other researchers had covered in one of their UFO books many years ago, which was this case was called the Quantock Horror. And it was in England, and the story had gone that there was this individual who had first said that he had seen a Mothman-like creature flying over the English countryside, and he took pictures of it, too. Well, the UFO investigators who came and interviewed this individual saw the photographs and said it was clearly a man on a hang glider. But this man had said that he always liked to go out and walk this particular stretch of the country where there were these high-power electrical pylons, and they actually ran over this stretch of the country and directly over his home. He said at night that he would be accosted by little blue midgets with a painful, paralyzing ray gun who would come into his home and shoot him with the ray gun and keep him from being able to move. And he was just being tormented, he said, by all these extra dimensional or otherworldly entities. And the determination had been that this guy actually was a clinical case sufferer of this electrical sensitivity and hyper or multiple allergy. kind of disorder, or one variant of it, and that this very well may have been the source of the hallucinations that he perceived as being possibly ufological. Now, that's not to say that every UFO contact is hallucinating, but I mean, I definitely think that there's like an electromagnetic component. So the funny thing is coming back to the discussion about natural light and fire, you know, sunlight versus artificial lighting sources and whatnot, even in a studio, as cool as it is to be in an awesome studio like Skeleton Studios or the Graylian Bunker, you know, that is situated on a part of the home, apart from where you're going to spend most of your time, maybe apart from, you know, all different kinds of things. I know I don't have a television in my bedroom. I try to keep the electrical devices in different, you know, parts mm-hmm. of my home. And even as cool as it is to be able to sit in a studio surrounded with gear, I remember in my days of radio, Forrest Connor and I, one of the other producers there at 570 AM, we'd always talk about this, what we called the electromagnetic blues. If you sat in a studio surrounded by gear for too long, or if you spent too much time, you know, with this great big high output RF transmitter out there on that great big field, I mean, you'd start feeling weird. You'd start feeling, I called it actually the EM sludge was my nickname for it. But a lot of people referred to it as a blues because they started feeling bad when they were, you know, perpetually bombarded by EM, you know, electromagnetic mm-hmm. fields. So, you know, I think that in the case with the couple that I'd gone and spoken with, the gal who had said that she had these presences, she had also said that she had had weird things happen, but it was always when she was close to electromagnetic sources, you know, of you know, different kinds of, mm-hmm. You know, appliances or those that are emitted by these appliances. And I don't know that I can say that she was actually a contactee any more than the Quantock gentleman who claimed that the midgets were blasting with blue rays. Who knows? I think that, you know, again, the way that these kind of things affect us and our bodies probably actually runs the gamut in terms of things, which remarkably in this modern age, we really don't really have a full, clear picture on. And so there are moments, I guess, where I look at all this and I do wonder, where are we going? What are we doing? How are we affecting our bodies, or how are these kinds of things, again, you know, talking specifically, whether it be electromagnetic or radiation from devices in our environment to the actual proximity that we hold to street light and, of course, artificial light sources at night, how much time we actually spend getting sunlight, I think as many of us need and probably don't get enough of, especially those of us who reside in the hollow earth. A lot of these questions are very relevant, and it makes you wonder, really, how are we affecting ourselves as our technology improves and the proliferation of that technology increases to an extent that, again, we are not what we once were? I think these are important questions that really have to be asked, and we'll continue with more question asking when we return here on the Graylian Report. From the wide expanses of the Drone Star State, I'm Micah Hanks, along with Cameron Hale of Expanded Perspectives, bringing you your Monday night Graylian Report, where we keep you company here every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, 5 p.m. here in Central time, which I'm adjusting to. Not as bad as having to head across the pond or anything like that, although I'm missing my friends across the British Isles. People all around the world, in fact, interacting with us tonight. Dan James, my brother, sending there a message on Twitter. He says, is it wise, Micah, to point out to your audience that sitting in front of a computer late at night may have adverse effects? Yeah. I think Dan's down in Australia.
Dan, shh.
I know Michael Joachim is actually at home right now. He said, listening to the Graylian Report, along with his family. Let's see here. All kinds of folks out there. Yeah, Jennifer Brander, the lovely Lady Claire, the Aussie in Ireland. Paul McBay, of course, down in our home away from home, Charleston, South Carolina, is very excited about tonight's program. Hope you guys all are just as well. I am just happy to be here. Oh, you know, the good doctor, Tyler Cokejohn, also asked if we would have a full investigation of Paramania featured. Yeah, we'll get to some more of that again in the second hour, because over the course of the weekend, I headed up to Dallas and was able to spend some time in Dealey Plaza. And it was my first time ever visiting the motorcade. Yeah, I got to see, in fact, I've got a photograph or two. Kyle took me out there and everything, and there it is. X literally marks the spot where it all went down, that dreaded day in Dallas. Yes, John F. Kennedy was shot. We'll talk about that more in the second hour. First of all, a little more of what's going on in the news. A fellow we've had on this program and who I met for the first time at the UFO conference that we're going to be attending together, Cam and Kyle and Hobbo and I, up in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, was Professor Antonio Paris. And he has been promoting a new crowdfunding effort to recreate the famous WOW or alien signal. Okay, for 72 seconds back in 1977, for those who don't know about this, the Big Ear Radio Telescope recorded this powerful signal. It seemed to be streaming from the area of globular cluster M55 around Sagittarius. Now, Ohio State astronomer Jerry Amon, who had been a SETI volunteer at the time, and I want to update you on what's happening with SETI in the search for ET here in a moment, but to him it seemed like the exact kind of an alien message that we've been hoping to find, evidence of, well, intelligence somewhere out there that might be paying attention to what we're doing down here. I don't know, Cam, would you and I qualify?
I definitely wouldn't. You might, but I definitely would not. I would be the great before, and then you would be the well, after photo, but yeah.
Yeah, well, Amon, you've probably seen this, in fact, Cam. You know, the actual readout showed this peak, and then he circled it and wrote next to it, WOW. Now, despite many searches, this so-called WOW signal was never observed again. And there are a lot of people who actually think that it was something terrestrial and had merely caused an anomalous spike on the instrument readings, but had not actually been something cosmic in origin. Others think this very well may have been, well, some sort of a intergalactic intercommunication sent along by some strange intervening extraterrestrial. So astronomers have ruled out earthly origins like a passing satellite. They do know that much, or even nearby asteroids or planets. The lasting unsolved mystery, however, has provided decades of fodder for science fiction writers and late-night alien TV shows. And I guess occasionally podcasts just as well, huh? So anyway, at St. Petersburg College in Florida, Antonio Paris, we've had him on the show before, he came up with this potential solution. And again, he says this doesn't require aliens. Now, at the time of the WOW signal, two sun-orbiting comets, 266P Christensen and P2008Y2 Gibbs, were in the same area of the sky, and Paris believes these dirty snowballs, as they were called, obviously an astronomical term, he said it was the hydrogen clouds that they produced that could have been the prime suspects. Now, lucky for him, he says that the comet 266P Christensen passes through that same region, okay, on January 25th of next year, 2017. And he says that on January 7th, 2018, comet P2008Y2, the Gibbs comet, is going to be doing the same thing. So he hopes to recreate the WOW signal by aiming a dedicated radio telescope at that region. Now, he says his team at the Center for Planetary Science is a little short on cash right now. They have launched a GoFundMe page for this, and I'll try and have that linked in the show notes. We'll try and tweet that out just as well, because I think it'd be fabulous if we could find out that this was the source of the WOW signal. I think with a lot of these mysteries, you know, people would really prefer that these things just remain mysterious.
I would.
Well, okay. You know, and there's an argument, and I want to come back to you on that.
Okay.
There's an argument to be made for that, but I think that in equal measure, I love Sherlock Holmes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in the tradition of the great detective, you know, you rule out what is found to be implausible and impossible, and what you're left with, that whatever that minutiae that is left after you've ruled out what cannot be remains the truth. Now, of course, that or similar quotes have been attributed to Spock, of course, the science advisor to the Starship Enterprise, over the years, but I think it really originated with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's character Sherlock Holmes. And I've always said that that's true. You know, if we really don't want to, you know, really delude ourselves and try and convince ourselves that there is more here to this apparent mountain than the molehill which actually exists, we have to be willing to accept that if we cannot prove it, if no further evidence supports our wild expectations or hopes or desires, let's trim it down through a process of elimination, except, you know, only what we have left at the table at the end of the day, and through a process of rational and proper inquiry. And so I like that Antonio is trying to rule out a possible anomalous event here, by recreating the circumstances, even though they were not, again, you know, exactly what was happening here on planet Earth. Some have tried to say that it may have just been some sort of an instrumental kind of a problem. But again, if he's looking so far out as to say that maybe the tails of comets or the hydrogen produced by them could have influenced the circumstances observed here on Terra Firma and caused the apparent so-called wow signal, if we can recreate that and we can rule out this as an anomalous event, well, it will, again, in the future, help us know what not to look for and thus actually increase our chances of finding evidence of extraterrestrial life. But there are, I think, some instances where it's safe to say, hey, it would be better if some things were to remain a mystery. I mean, your thoughts, Cam?
There's two things that I always go to with this. You have to bear with me because this is it's kind of strange. The first thing is this. The first thing is I love the awe and the mystery of this world.
I do.
There's things that I don't want to be. We've discussed numerous times, and we all sat out here and had beers one night and discussed Bigfoot.
That's every night.
Yeah, truly. And I want it to be real. I want that to be real, and I don't want it to be found. I know that's the only way it's going to be proven, but I like the air of mystery. I like the fun in being a grown child and being involved in this and wanting these things. But there's part of me that doesn't want this to ever be proven one way or the other. It's that mystery is fun. The same with now I understand whenever it was life threatening. Like if you feel like I've never been abducted by aliens. I can't speak whether anybody on this planet has or has not.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was not there. But I know people that claim they have been, and it is a life-altering experience for those people. And if it is truly going on, and this is truly happening to these people, then we need to get to the bottom of that, because that is affecting the lives of people. But just going to the woods with friends and family and looking for these creatures, that's benefiting somebody. You're getting in the outdoors, you're getting outside, you're getting some extra. It's benefiting, as long as it stays in the right path, a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I also look at it this way. We're trying to prove this. Antonio, we've spoken to Antonio here, and he's proven a lot of things. He goes very scientific. That's what I like about Antonio and the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I always think about this, too. We dismiss lots of things like, all right, we've proven that it doesn't exist. We've proven this, that we prove that's where it came from. Did we? Or do we not have the technology in order to test scientifically how to detect these certain things, and we're just kind of recreating it? Because I could make a cup out of glass, or I can make a cup out of wood, or I can make a cup out of clay. All three are vessels that hold fluids, but all three are made of different things. So if you look at all these things, you're like, yeah, you recreated it. But that may not actually be where that came from, just because you found something that recreates the sound. I believe that's called Foley art whenever they do it in the movies. When they make certain sounds, it's really not the sound of that movie as somebody walking up the stairs, but the recorded sound of somebody on a Foley stage walking upstairs.
Right.
You've recreated that sound, but not what you just saw in the movie. That's not where it was recorded. So there's two different ways, and that's the way I feel about some of these things. Is I'm like, yeah, we can do it, but maybe... This is my dreamer side still. Maybe we don't have the technology to truly find exactly where it came from. And that comes full circle to me going, I don't want a lot of these mysteries to be solved. Man, I miss the whole idea. And you know where it starts from? Indiana Jones as a kid. That's where it starts from. That's what I'm guilty of.
Oh, but that was it for so many of us. By the way, I want to bring things around to philosophy for just a second, because I have always considered myself, not always, but lately I adopted this part-time moniker, as the backseat philosopher, just because I thought it was funny. I mean, I'm not a qualified, educated philosopher, but I consider myself to be a person who is indeed an advocate of and a practitioner of logical thought and philosophy. Again, you know, really, I mean, a PhD, to hold a PhD merely means, the actual literal meaning, I should say, of PhD is a doctor of philosophy. And philosophy, of course, the term... the etymology of that word, rather, meaning a lover of knowledge. So if I'm a backseat philosopher, from the backseat to the backwoods, you're the backwoods philosopher. And that's why enjoy talking with you, brother.
I'm all right with that.
Especially when you got to the point there about, you know, the different cups being filled. I really enjoyed and appreciate that kind of perspective on things. So, and just like you were talking about Antonio, that's what I appreciate about him just as well. He's trying to apply logic, and he's trying to separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it's not to say that we can't enjoy mysteries, and I do enjoy mysteries because we talk about them. But I think in equal measure, though, in terms of the assessment and the collection of new data and learning things about the world around us, yeah, we obviously have to try and communicate good ideas, which I think we try to do. I know that you guys definitely do, especially with expanded perspectives, and that's something I appreciate about you fellas. Before we move on to this next story in this series that I'm featuring tonight here, talking about the ongoing search for aliens, and not only how we can hope to try and find them, SETI's actually working on something new. They got a great idea, and while we're practicing turning out our lights down here for the International Dark Sky Week, SETI observers are actually looking for darker stars. First, I just want to toss this out to you. How can people find you and Kyle on the web with the Expanded Perspectives podcast? I doubt there are many in the Graylian audience who don't listen to these guys already, and vice versa. But in case you're not listening, you need to be. How can they find you, brother?
You can go to iTunes. You can search us up on Expanded Perspectives. You can go on, we're on Facebook under Expanded Perspectives, Twitter under the same. You can go, what else have I got? Instagram. We all have our own stuff. We all have our own expandedperspectives.com on the website. It's pretty much, if you Google search Expanded Perspectives and you see a picture of what looks like Bigfoot and a whole group of wild friends of his at like Washington crossing the Delaware, that's going to be us. And you can pretty much find us real quick and easy.
There it is. Excellent. Yeah. And do check them out. They're quite good. Let's see. Actually, you know, we're up on a break. I should really go to the break before we come back and try and fill this out. But again, SETI is targeting different kinds of stars in the ongoing search for what we hope will be, I think, the ultimate realization. We are not alone in the universe. That is yet to come. And we will feature that once we return here again on the program you know and love. And tune into every Monday night or worldwide around the globe on demand via the World Wide Web, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you may find us. The Graylian Report podcast just as well, which we upload at the website graylianreport.com every week. Y'all hang in there, as we say down here in Texas. I'm the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks. We will be back again right after this. Backseat to the backwoods, broadcasting live from the heart of Texas. I'm Micah Hanks, along with co-host Cam Hale. This is the Graylian Report. Now, Cam, of course, is not a regular, but I, well, irregularly like to have him here. He's one of the co-hosts of Expanded Perspectives, as we heard in that last segment. Glad to have him here, as always. So, as we've been talking about dark sky and, of course, the search for crowdfunding or just finding new ways to find alien life, right now the search for intelligent aliens has expanded to include thousands of star systems, very different from that of Earth. As reported by Space.com, scientists with the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, have just begun a two-year hunt for signs of alien civilizations. They're seeing around 20,000 red dwarfs, stars considerably smaller and dimmer than Earth's sun. If it wasn't blue midgets, it's now red dwarfs.
Right. I like how close you came to saying starships.
Yeah.
And you were trying, I'm like, I know where he's going with this.
Yeah.
Freudian slip. Yeah. I know what he's thinking about.
Yeah, I just love those rockets. So the red dwarfs are promising targets for SETI scientists. They're the most common stars in the Milky Way, making up about 75% of the galaxy's stellar population. And because red dwarfs burn through their fuel slowly, they live for an awful long time. On average, the Milky Way's red dwarfs are billions of years older than the sun, according to researchers. Now, SETI Institute astronomer, you'll know him well, Seth Shostak. He does a lot of the late-night radio programs and TV just as well. He says this may be one instance in which older actually is better. Older star systems have had more time to produce intelligent species, he says. Now, despite these characteristics, SETI hunts to date have only really focused on sun-like stars, and there are reasons why. For one thing, the one example of life that scientists, of course, know about resides in such a system. Hey, talking about us right here. But again, see, this comes back around to the whole thing about, you know, well, look at this again. The sun, you know, is the evidence of life that we know, at least the only life that we know conclusively to exist throughout the universe. We look for similar circumstances in terms of habitable regions where there's a natural solar source of light. In addition, red dwarfs possess relatively narrow habitable zones. See, the range of distances from a star at which liquid water can exist on a world's surface. Furthermore, any planets in a red dwarf's habitable zone would be quite close to the star and would therefore likely be tidally locked, showing just one face to the star. Like, you know, the moon shows just one face to the Earth. Hence why we always see the man on the moon and not his rear end.
Well, and I always laugh, too, because I did the exact same thing. They talk about liquid water. I just started laughing when I heard that whole part online. I was like, liquid water. Is there any other liquid water? I'm like, come on, I get it. Just I can't just put water? I'm like, now y'all are just trying to get too scientific for me.
I need to make sure that the water that you provide for me is liquid.
When it's liquid.
Next time I go to a restaurant, I'm going to do that. I'm going to like, I would like a water, but please make sure that it's liquid water that's
I'll
presented
take
in the glass.
Liquid water, please.
I'll take liquid water in a vessel.
Yes. In a vessel?
Yes, no heavy water. No deuterium. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I need liquid water.
That was a key word, right? The NSA is listening now, aren't they?
Probably. Nah. Well, they might. They probably already were. Yeah.
Yeah. So now there's new research about this. New stuff has come to light.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, which has caused a reassessment of red dwarf systems' potential habitability. And this is why they're looking at red dwarfs. They say exoplanet discoveries recently, and we carry a lot of these. As a matter of fact, God, I think over the last two or three days, there have been two or three stories at least that have talked about the newest exoplanetary discoveries, which we featured there at the Graylian Report News, the daily news that we put up there at the site. And apparently it's suggested that these discoveries of exoplanets, once again, seem to indicate a large fraction of red dwarfs between one-sixth and one-half, in fact, may host planets in their habitable zone. And modeling work indicates that even tidally locked planets could conceivably support Earth-like life if they harbor oceans and an atmosphere, which together would transport heat around such worlds. Now, another SETI Institute scientist, Jerry Harpist, said we'll scrutinize targeted systems over several frequency bands between 1 and 10 gigahertz. Roughly half of those bands will be at so-called magic frequencies, places on the radio dial, that is, that are directly related to basic mathematical constants. It's reasonable to speculate that extraterrestrials trying to attract attention might generate signals at such special frequencies. Now, while the SETI Institute guys, Cam, are out there looking for aliens, and before we wrap up this hour, if we've got time, I want to come back around to the kind of dichotomy ideologically between those who think that aliens are already here and this ongoing search for aliens. Is there a great divide or is there common ground, logically or otherwise? We'll come back to that in a moment, but I want to say first that there is, according to the BBC right now, a totally different concept being espoused about actually, rather than searching for alien life, using lasers to cloak the Earth so that aliens can't find us. Did you see this?
No, but I am fascinated by the fact that we're going to engage the cloaking device.
Yes, 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 yes. So the beams are being suggested by two U.S.-based astronomers, which could compensate for the dip in light the Earth creates when it passes in front of the sun. A number of researchers have questioned the wisdom, of course, of advertising to aliens that might exist out there whether we're here or not. Stephen Hawking's one of them. They essentially fear that if aliens did visit us, they might not be very friendly.
I've always been against the whole idea of sending that stuff out.
Yeah,
I don't like the idea of it. I don't like the idea of giving away what we're made out of. Nah.
Well, and the thing is that if aliens that might exist out there anywhere in the universe have evolved in any way intellectually and in terms of the development of consciousness, if they have developed in any way similarly to us with their intelligence and the modes in which they operate, in likelihood they are asking the same questions. They are probably not so foolish and utopian as to say that all that they may encounter may, again, be friendly. And therefore, again, an argument that could be made, and I think it's a fair argument, as to why we do not have conclusive scientific evidence of the existence of ET is that they may do the same thing. They may be using lasers or anything else to hide themselves because they're afraid of guys like us down here dropping nuclear warheads on one another.
Well, how arrogant are we as a species
to
just send it out and be like, all right, if they want to come down here, cool, and y'all need to come meet us because we're the cool kids.
Have you read a history book?
Yeah, right?
You know, that seems to kind of be how it is. I mean, there's nothing really else to say about that. You know, lasers could cloak the Earth from aliens, and some are saying while we're searching different places now and trying to find new ways to find aliens, we're also really having to also think of ways that we might protect ourselves from being discovered by them. It's a weird kind of a catch-22, isn't it?
That is. That is really strange. We want to be found, but we only want to hide from them until we know that they're okay. Then we'll like flip the switch and be like, we were here the whole time. Whoops. Yeah, I couldn't trust anything. They send you into space. I'd like go up into space, and then they would hit the lasers. I'd turn and be like, the Earth's gone. I can't find my way home, you know? Be like, that'd be like the joke, like the big brother plays on a little brother. Go outside. And he locks the door and turns the light off.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Be me in space.
Unfortunately, I was that big brother once, too. Yeah. Poor Caleb.
Yep. Poor Caleb. Poor Caleb.
Yeah, now I've got big brothers like Cam and Kyle who do the same thing to me. Yeah. It's like, come on down here. You can stay down here. And you see why I'm always talking about staring at the sky? It's because they locked me outside with a cat at night.
We have been known to put him out there with Hazel Cat more than once.
It does happen. So that brings us up to another question of dichotomy. While we're trying to hide from aliens and yet trying to use our intelligence and ingenuity to find new ways that we may spot them, by equal measure, there is the question about why are we looking for aliens? Some would say the evidence is here. We've known all along. We've known for many decades. Now, I would say that, again, I don't think that UFO literature presents conclusive evidence of alien interactions. And again, a simple reason why would be if you look at some of the incidents that we discussed earlier, like the Quantock Horror or the couple that I visited many years ago who, again, they had certainly said that they thought that there were presences. And in not so many words, they'd suggested that they thought that these might be extraterrestrial that were communicating with them. I thought that there were very clear, down-to-earth, circumstantial reasons why they were experiencing these kind of things that had to do with their environment. I don't think that it was aliens trying to make contact. And I think that when we look throughout UFO literature, maybe not everything can be so easily explained, but there are a wide range of esoteric in the sense that really many do not know of them, which does not, I think, take away from their veracity. But there are a number of contributing factors to what may be the growing body of alleged alien contacts people have said that they've had over the years. And then you meet somebody like Travis Walton, who I actually think had a legitimate experience so many years ago. He's going to be up there. No, he won't be in Eureka Springs.
He'll be in Aurora.
And you're going to go out there. Have you met Travis before?
Never have, but that's going to change in a couple weeks.
Well, I met him, and I find him interesting. I think of him to be a person, again, who is, very believable. I've always found it interesting that, throughout the large part of his experience, apart from when he immediately woke up and said that there were these strange beings in the room with him, throughout the broader narrative, he actually described seeing people, aliens or whatever that looked like people.
Yeah, that's what I find the most interesting.
Yeah, and again, having sat and had lunch with him and talked about that, I mean, I find his case extremely compelling. So, Cam, what would you say to people who would, tell us, SETI is not doing anything really worth a damn. We're wasting our time. Evidence of aliens, we don't need evidence. It's already here. Stephen Bassett says this. He says that the UFO era has ended and now it's exopolitics. We already know UFOs are here and they are alien. Alien, therefore, that question of whether we are alone in the universe has been answered. I'm just not so sure. What do you think?
I think there's a dividing line that we don't like to acknowledge. And the dividing line is the people that really want to know the truth about UFOs and what's been seen in the alien. And then the people that just want to think of that, the fact that they're flying saucers, like the old school stuff that we see in the sky. And it's like just driving by a truck stop. And that's what they do when they drive by here, is they stop here for whatever they need and they keep going, something like that. I think there's two different, complete different camps that we'll never see eye to eye, no matter what they do. I tell you what it feels like. My feeling is if there were extraterrestrials, and even if there are extraterrestrial, they are already here. And the only thing that they're doing is basically blending in and controlling whatever they can control. Because I think back of this, name one animal species that has benefited completely from our intervention. Yeah, they may be safe than they were, but it's never good when we first get there. So why not interject yourself into, I think of the Spaniards landing in South America. The Mayan were doing just fine. They were living their Mayan life, and then they rolled through and changed everything and wiped a bunch of stuff. I kind of feel like that. Like there's, I look at our history books and I feel like the same thing is, this is the first time in history that someone landing upon your shores in a ship didn't include swords and shields.
Right.
So whenever somebody landed at your door, it wasn't a fist fight constantly. So this is the first time that people land. You're like, hey, glad to see you. I feel like maybe intergalactically, I don't even know if that's a word, but it is now.
It works now.
I believe that if they land, it's what's the easiest way to do? To befriend and blend in, or to just start fighting constantly? It's way easier to befriend and blend in.
Yeah, I think so, man. That'll be the final word for this hour. When we come back, we are going to take a minute to get to a couple of emails from the listeners, because someone wrote in with a very interesting update on the Kenny Veach disappearance. We talked about that a while back. We're going to revisit that and a new update on that, as well as a discussion of what happened at the Dallas Motorcade this weekend at Paramania. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Carrying along Cosmogirally as we continue our foray into Fortiana tonight, I am Micah Hanks. And it is the one and only Graylian Report. Broadcasting, however, from the studio of my bruds down here in Weatherford, Cam and Kyle of Expanded Perspectives, who are always the finest hosts in all of Fortiana. Glad to have Cam right here in studio with me, rocking it out to you a little bit tonight. You know, I think Kyle was the first one who ever reached out to me. But you know, Cam and I, then we probably spent about the next, maybe, I don't know, month on the telephone.
You know, so
going over stuff. Both these guys really are just like brothers. And definitely check them out, expandedperspectives.com. And while you're web surfing, if you haven't already, you might want to head over to www.graylianreport.com/X, where you can sign up. You can become a new subscriber. Melissa Jane, our latest, who signed up just today up in New York. Hey, I'm going to come up and visit sometime. Because you know what? They have events up there, and she actually is involved in this sort of thing. And she said, you know, we ought to do a Graylian meetup up here in New York, and I thought it'd be really great. We've got a lot of listeners in the Big Apple, so welcome, Melissa. Come on down and claim your spot down here in the bunker, or down there in the bunker, since I'm in Weatherford right now. But I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Wish I could stick around long enough to come with you to Aurora, though, Cam.
It's going
to
be fun. Of course, I've been up there. Like we said, you know, we visited up there this past weekend. Kyle and I have been there numerous times. Your first trip down, we took you over there, which is what was interesting about that trip was, when it was just us three,
yeah,
the first time, we were looking for and basically discussing, you know, where would it might be. And I remember the first thing I told you was, let's look for the oldest trees in the cemetery.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking that.
And where were we standing?
No, you called it. And you usually
do. That's
crazy.
I was like, yes.
No, you usually do. You said, where would be the oldest trees in the cemetery? And sure enough, when we find...
Where we were standing, when we get there, there's Jim.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, well, you know, is this like an urban legend? Do we really know that there's anything that ties this location? Okay, for those who don't know what we're talking about, by the way, let me just back up a little bit. Okay, again, the story is that around, I believe it was 1897, mm-hmm, according to local legend there in Aurora, Texas, an airship crashed. And that the pilot of this airship had actually been, he had died and presumably sort of burned all to hell there in that crash that occurred. And so they carried the body over to the little Aurora cemetery. It's a Masonic cemetery. There's some really interesting headstones in the cemetery.
Really? Yeah, it's fun, isn't it?
Did you see the one with the SR-71 Blackbird
on
it?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've got video of Cam and I actually crouched down, sitting and talking there, mm-hmm, in the from last year when we went by. So I never really thought, actually, that 2 years in a row I'd actually be going out there. And that the first time we went, it was just, you know, Cam and Kyle and I. That was pretty awesome. And then we go back, and Jim Mars just happens to be hanging out in the cemetery. I guess this is what Jim does in his spare time. He hangs out in cemeteries.
Yeah, he's like my pawpaw when I see him every time. I always remind him of my grandpa.
Yeah. So, and lo and behold, he's talking to this group of our people who are standing around, and his friend Daniel, who had actually been attending the Paramania thing, and he had a little manila folder, And he said, yeah, this was the spot, Mike, and I'll show you why. And he shows me the photograph, and I had my iPhone, and I said, Jim, can I take a picture of this? And he says, yeah, brother, come on, you know. So I take a photograph of the little spot, and there was the half of the headstone that had been there. It was like chopped in there, or someone had broken it and actually carried part of it away. But it showed this strange triangular shape. Have you seen that photo?
I don't think I have seen that. I saw him with the envelope, and I didn't mess with him, you know, Jim's... Jim literally lives like 30 minutes from us, and we always say we're going to get him. Imagine taking your grandpa somewhere. So we're going to have to go get Jim and bring him down and all that stuff and the whole thing. But no, I have not seen that photo.
Here it is. I'm going to hand it over to you. We've got this live in the studio. This is the photograph taken by Jim Mars in 1973.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah, of the headstone, which he said that had it been complete, seemed to show a disc or kind of triangle-shaped object with lights on the sides, which apparently was the headstone that commemorated the crash landing and the burial of the pilot right there. So that is a really weird looking image. Yeah, you can see Jim's little photograph there that he'd taken, that scan of the 1973 photo, and he talked about that in his book Alien Agenda. And then we head across the street, of course, to this location where the well actually had been, which was by the windmill that they said that the thing crashed into. Now, I mean, there are a lot of like local legends all throughout every part of the United States. And I was criticized last time I wrote about this because I'd done a quick blog just about while I was down here last year. You know, we went out and met Lyle Blackburn at Lake Worth. And then, of course, we went out there to the Aurora Cemetery. And, you know, yeah, so there were negative blog posts written about me because I can't go on vacation without people wanting to try and pick apart. And it's not because of the factual relevance. It was actually they were upset that I was mentioning Jim Mars. There's some people that don't like Jim Mars. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, having been the guy who has not only written about UFOs and things like this, but also very controversial political conspiratorial works, such as the book Crossfire, which was one of those which influenced the making of the film JFK by Oliver Stone.
I actually have a first edition, first run copy of that book that he signed.
Really?
Of Crossfire, yeah, and my stuff, the whole deal. It's one of those things, when you grow up around here, the JFK conspiracy is something that's basically inundated in your body from the jump. I mean, it's just something that it's... Here's what's funny is... I guess I can't speak for anybody from the Roswell Times that would think about the way it was when they grew up, just instantly believing the story. But I remember growing up in a household where it was almost like common knowledge to my father. The way he always talked about it was he was like, of course there was multiple shooters involved. Of course there was more involved than what they was told. I mean, the whole thing. And my father based all of his ideas on the magic bullet from the Warren Report.
Yeah.
And as a young man, when I say a young man, I'm talking like a child. I mean, I received my first firearm when I was 5 years old. I received a rifle for my birthday, a small 22 caliber rifle. So I was raised with guns. When I say my entire, I'm 40 now. So for 35 years of my life, I've always had guns all the time. I've never once, out of all the times I have fired guns, seen a bullet like that. And I mean full metal jacketed, armor piercing rounds. I got friends in the military. We get together and shoot. Never seen a bullet go through flesh and bone and come out the other side looking like that. Especially not doing all they said it did. And I just find it very strange. I'm not saying it was wrong. I'm not saying anything, folks. Before you start tweeting and sending emails, I'm just saying that bullet smells a little like BS.
Let's see here. How do we do this? The opinions expressed on this program may not necessarily reflect those of the host or the institution known as the Graylian International.
Yeah, exactly. Don't blame them. You can come after me. That's fine. But I'm just saying I think there's a little bit more to it than what is going, what they tell you.
No, it's a fair question. And for those who, and we're going to talk a little later this hour more about that as I recount my own experience with Kyle going up there to the motorcade, and he took me down and showed me everything. Obviously, he's been up there. I mean, he knew all about it and everything. And that was with the Paranomania crowd.
X marks the spot.
Well, yeah, yeah. And he's not kidding, folks. There's actually a X out there on the road. So in the next segment, we're going to talk about that. First, as promised, I do want to go to a couple of emails, and then I'll tell you about the Paramania crowd heading out to this. And again, for those who are saying, oh, man, where was the website for this event? Well, this was kind of more like a gathering than it was a public event. And I was actually asked by those who were putting this on, don't say too much about this. So very little was said about this event. That's the reason why. And now, in hindsight, I can talk about it. But it was Greg Bishop and Red Pill Junkie and Tim Banal of America and a few others. So, you know, we wanted to get down to Texas and have a few days. We wanted to do our own little creature of Jekyll Island. You know, we're going to start a national bank. Just kidding. I don't want the feds to actually investigate us here. But no. Seriously, we're just getting together to actually just have cocktails and good conversation about the unusual. As we're about to share in that dialogue, that same sort of conversation that I try to feature often on this program with you who send in your emails, info@graylianreport.com, info@micahhanks.com is how you can reach us. Boy, I tell you, before we dive into this, I want to say I'm holding on pretty good, aren't I? You can hear my vocal cords are still slightly tattered, and it may not sound like it overtly out there. I probably sound a little different because tonight here in Skeleton Studios, rather than hooking up my big honking microphone or the BCD-1 I brought as a backup, since Kyle said he wasn't going to be able to be in studio tonight, I said, great. I'll just use whatever you guys have hooked up, which is a pair of Heil PR40 microphones. This is the microphone that was used famously by Art Bell when he hosted Coast to Coast back in the old days.
No, it's the exact microphone.
Oh, this was his.
No, I'm kidding.
You want to know a funny story? Let me tell you a funny story about that before we get to the listener stories. I actually approached Art Bell and asked if I could buy his PR40 one time. Did you ever hear this?
No.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. So back before Art had launched his comeback, the ill-fated comeback, unfortunately, he's now off the air again. And I'm sad to hear that because I think we all look at him as a true icon in this field. He was on Facebook, and before he had maxed out at the 5,000 limit, I saw him on Facebook, and I thought, well, what have I got to lose? So I sent Art a friend request on Facebook, and he accepted it. And unlike a lot of these celebrity-type accounts, Art operates his own personal Facebook. He posts his own personal messages, pictures of his family and things like that on there. And so I wrote to Art one time, and I thought, what have I got to lose? At that time, I didn't know that he had been planning a prospective radio comeback. And I wrote to him and I said, Art, if you've got that old PR40 lying around, name the price. If you're interested at all in selling it, I would love to buy a microphone from you. Or even if not the PR40 that you used in the C2C years, I mean, if you've got a microphone, I'd love to own a microphone that had been owned by Art Bell. Again, with utmost respect to the man. Again, you don't have to agree with all the stories, all the callers, all the guests over the years that he had on his program, which ranged from, again, some fringe crazies to, I think, obviously, some of those stories like that of Mel's Hole, which you guys talked about recently on Expanded Perspectives. I think that was actually what we would call a radio inside job in the sense that I think that it was a fabricated story, but,
in the fight game, they'd call it a work.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes. In occultism, we'd call it the Amalantra working. But, again, I actually find Art's approach to radio was really good. And the number one thing that I want to say before people criticize that sort of stuff is, it is entertainment before it is anything else. When people come out to the events, they meet me and they're like, Micah, it's funny because I hear you and all the stories you tell and how funny you are on the radio. And then when we actually start talking about UFOs and stuff, at these events, you're funny and you're charming, but you're also really, really serious about this stuff, aren't you? And I'm like, well, yeah. And the reason why is because there is a difference between what you hear on the podcast, which again, I am always myself. But if you read a book I've written, you're not going to have quite as much humor and hilarity. Well, the complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting actually is quite humorous because it's a book about podcasting and I'm humorous when I'm podcasting. But with my serious research into these kind of things, yes, I'm very serious. I always strive for, seriousness. And especially since the authorship of The Ghost Rockets, that book, more than any, I think, represent my more skeptical, attuned mindset toward the phenomena we're addressing. So I do take it seriously. Art, I think, does take these things seriously. And I think that Art really always was very honorable in his approaches and interesting as a host. But he also recognized that this is about entertainment. And he was one of the most entertaining radio hosts probably ever to have come about. So yeah, I contacted him and I said, I would love to own a piece of the history of this program and what you did if you'd ever think of selling me a microphone. And he never wrote back. But that's okay. I know he can't respond to everybody. But here tonight in Skeleton Studios, chatting it up with Cam and of course, with all you guys out there listening tonight, talking through this Heil PR40, it's funny because there's a certain sense of cadence that I think comes with working with a microphone like this. A little different from the MXL V900 that I'd normally use. And it's funny because it almost gets you in that kind of mindset. We could just wait. We could take this show until well after dark, and we could broadcast into the wee hours of the morning. We could take live calls out there from folks like you, just hear weird stories all night. The likes of which some of you actually write in with every week and tell. Kimberly, in fact, is one of those. She writes, you know, Mike, I've only recently found out that you could download podcasts. Yes, I'm a wee bit behind the times, but I've been listening to TGR at work, and I have really been enjoying it. Hey, that's actually a fair question, Kimberly. I should say, you can stream the show from my website, graylianreport.com, but you can also download it on iTunes. You can also download it on Stitcher. And, of course, if you want to listen live, like a lot of the people out there do, you can just go on over there to, KGRAradio.com, but we actually have the live link embedded at MicahHanks.com and GraylianReport.com. Either way, you'll get the KGRA stream, and that is what carries the live show from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time. She says, anyway, I have had a few friends and family in the spy business, or having high security clearances. It occurs to me that targeting the president is the wrong avenue to get information. And she's referencing, by the way, what we talked about last week on the program. Yes, he has a high clearance, but it is not the highest, as many people believe. Point in fact, he is a temp, as in temporary employee. Now, think about this, Cam. I'd never thought about this myself. Thinking of the president as a temporary employee. But again, you know, a maximum lifespan of, well, you know, okay, yeah, it's supposed to be two terms, and there have been exceptions to that rule, FDR, for instance. But in general terms, you're not going to be able to, you know, maintain the presidency like, you know, again, a dictatorship, which in which that person, unless they are overthrown, a coup d'etat occurs, and that person is overthrown, that administration, yeah, you know, you're not going to have that kind of thing happen. Yes, he has a high clearance, but it's not the highest, as many people believe. He should not have full access to national secrets. He has not had the same training in surviving capture that many of the CIA, the NSA, and others have had. Can you imagine Joe Schmo Obama, for instance, or anybody else, getting kidnapped or turning on the U.S. after he has had access to everything and anything that he wanted? That's an interesting question. Would the head of the Skunk Works give the same access to a temp secretary that his regular assistant has? UFO and UAP researchers should be targeting career officials in the U.S. Air Force, the CIA, and at Wright-Patterson, commanders and those in similar positions. It's just a thought. Keep up the good work, Kimberly. Hey, you know, that's actually a great thought.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I always bring to mind, and we talked about it last week on the show, but I'll say again here, all you got to do is go back and look at what Jimmy Carter said when he asked for the UFO information. Then CIA Director George Herbert Walker Bush simply replied, "Sir, Mr. President, you don't have a need to know for that information." And I know that that's probably troubling to a lot of people because it says a lot more about government than I think that many of us know, but it is the reality of the world in which we live. Matt writes, "Dear Micah, well, it's been some time since I have been in touch. I'm still an avid listener, so I'm wondering if you would kindly help me out. I'm contacting you today in my role as member of the Center for Fortean Zoology. Every year we hold a rather fun, slightly anarchic..." How are you slightly anarchic? So anyway, his words, not mine. "An anarchic event in Devon in the UK called Weird Weekend. This year I've been charged with the promotion, so I was wondering if it would be possible to get a shout out about it on the Graylian Report. Hence, we read the email. Ye ask and ye shall receive, right?" Yeah. But actually, the truth is, I am loosely affiliated. Matt, you may not know this. I am loosely affiliated with the Center for Fortean Zoology. Did you know this?
Loosely. Yeah. I knew it loosely.
You knew it loosely? What by that, I mean the following. I am loosely affiliated because Nick Redfern, who, where is he? He should be here tonight.
I know. We need to, I'm going to have to go abduct Nick.
Well, his car's broken down right now, isn't it?
Allegedly.
Yes, we can neither confirm nor deny.
Exactly. I've not laid eyes upon it, so I can't say for sure.
But we speculate that his car has been broken down.
Yes.
Okay. Nick is apparently the kind of the American leg of the Center for Fortean Zoology, headed by John Downs in the UK. And he had once reached out and said that he'd like to have a person who is a representative in every U.S. state. And so this was years ago, but I said to him, I said, "Nick, what would you think about me being the U.S. Representative?" And he said, "Yeah, that's great." And so for the longest time, I actually had the emblem there on the Graylian Report website as the, you know, Center for Fortean Zoology representative here in, well, up in North Carolina, the old North State where I reside. So I don't know if they're still honoring that, but at one time I was actually a representative for the very said organization, hence why, again, I'm very proud to mention it right here. And I've asked for Matt just to send along some more information about that. And in fact, maybe we can get John Downs on the show or somebody else and have them come on and just talk a little about cryptozoology and exactly what they mean by Fortean zoology. Although I presume that by the mention of the aforementioned Fortean term, it's already been evidenced for the listener. But I want to take a little time to go back in time real quick with Matt. He had sent along a story some time ago about a wild man, which we'll revisit here. When Matt initially wrote in, we actually featured this on the show, but he said, I used to live in Cornwall, not too far from Land's End in the UK. The area is mostly moorland and reaches to the cliffs and the sea. Wooded areas are few and far between. But just out of the little town of St. Ives, there are some small woods that the locals call Steeple Woods due to an old monument nearby. Now, there was a gentleman who lived in the woods who, by anyone's standards, was a wild man. He had shunned society completely, deciding to live a life that appealed to him more than what modern life had to offer, and had built himself a shelter or a camp well away from the areas that other people would go. He was often naked, even in the depths of the British winter, and very much liked to keep himself to himself. Although I should point out that he was a friendly and kind soul, and so a very good friend of mine was one of the few friends, and we, along with two kids, went to visit him one evening. She wouldn't take us directly to his camp, so myself and my kids settled down in another part of the woods and built a small fire. Sometime later, my friend would return with the guy who was called Knocker, who, out of politeness to the kids, had put on a t-shirt, which would cover his modesty. Well, we sat around the fire and talked about things that sadly I can't remember now, and he taught the youngest child a few bits of woodcraft, like what plants were and which ones were good to eat, how to drink out of a stream. He was a great knight, or rather, the entire night was great, and we sat in the woods with a small fire smoking cigarettes and chatting. He showed the kids that there is more to life than just four walls and a job. Yeah, Knocker sounds like the kind of guy I'd like to have met, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So sadly, not long after he was found dead in his camp, and I won't go into the details, but it was saddened me greatly, and those who had been lucky enough to meet him were lucky. So the idea, he said, of feral humans living out in the wilds out of choice doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I think a lot of people find it strange, but I think I can appreciate living life your own, with each day being your own and having no one to answer to, although I don't think I'd survive more than a few days without Wi-Fi and laptop. The thought of not having my favorite podcast also would be too much to bear. What's his favorite podcast, I wonder? Matt, you should write in and tell us. I can also imagine in countries like the U.S., with all the wonderful wilderness that you guys have there, that perhaps many generations have lived this way. Maybe they now have no concept of how other people live and are just as perplexed when they see us as we see them. Hope this finds you and the rest of the Graylian gang happy and well. That was, again, Matt's email from some time ago, but I wanted to revisit it here because it was just very interesting what he had to say. Boy, if we had more time, Cam, I'd say we should get into a little discussion about the Big Thicket, you know, talking about the remote wilds of America. I do have one more email I've got to get to, and then when we come back, we'll get into some of this JFK discussion on the heels of our trip out to the Dallas Motorcade. But first, this is one that Rick sent along. I didn't have time to get to it last week, which is why we got to do it this week. And he wrote in with a update about a case that we discussed on this show some time ago. He says, it's a pleasure to email you. I'm a listener of the Graylian Report, and a few months back in the archives, I was listening today about the disappearance of Kenny Veach. So I went to the YouTube page. I'm not sure if you have already spoke about it, but his girlfriend posted on it 1 month ago, and she feels he committed suicide since he was battling depression. Now, below in the post she made, and I thought you might find this interesting, the following statement. I'm also one of those listeners, by the way, that's been considering starting a podcast of my own. Good luck, by the way, Rick. If you need any pointers, I'll be happy to send those along. Here's what he sent by Kenny's girlfriend, posted on his YouTube page. Now, again, you'll remember, Kenny was the guy who had gone looking for this alleged M-shaped cave out there in Nevada near Nellis Air Force Base. He put up a number of videos on his YouTube page. He didn't find the cave, went back to try and find it, and vanished. They found his phone lying next to an abandoned mine shaft, no body within the shaft, no body nearby. He remains missing. So his girlfriend posts on his page the following, and this is what she had to say. I am the girlfriend that Kenny spoke of in the video. There are so many posts. I had no idea until a friend let me know. So many people are wondering what happened and guessing different things. Now, you're heartfelt about the sadness around what has happened with Kenny. He has not been found, and I feel that he probably will not be found for many, many months, if ever. I want to share what I know and feel about what happened so that you might bring some closure and understanding in your own lives. Again, remember, she posted this on the YouTube page. She's addressing all the people who have commented there. Mm-hmm. Kenny absolutely loved hiking in the desert. It was his very, very favorite thing to do. We hiked and camped together all over the Nevada desert, sometimes 9 hours in a day. We found many abandoned mining towns, usually referred to as ghost towns by Nevada hikers. We explored many caves and mine shafts. We were always careful how we explored them, but Kenny was a bit more daring than I was. We wore snake guards, sun-protected clothing, used walking sticks, brought enough water and food for the hiking hours, and had extra water and food in the car. He rarely ever drank water. He even says that in one of his videos. He'd get out there, and he's kind of in his zone, and he'd just get out there and just go walking. He said, "I wouldn't drink much water." He'd go as long as he could to see how well he could last in case he ever actually found himself in an actual emergency situation where he had to really ration.
He had to rely on that.
Yeah. So he's, she writes, "We took wonderful pictures of all sorts of things we saw. Rusted cars, old falling down buildings, cemeteries, mines, wild animals, tarantulas, scorpions, trees, cactuses, flowers. Our deserts are beautiful if you have a love for deserts. And they're not spooky, scary, but you do have to be careful of the terrain and, of course, bring enough water and food. We always were excited when we saw desert wildlife, like the bighorn sheep in the video. They are stunningly beautiful to see in person in our desert. We would stand quietly still to watch them as long as possible, and I was so very excited to see the one that he filmed in his video. I want you to know that I do not think Kenny had an accident. I believe he committed suicide. He battled depression for many years and would not take medication or see a doctor." A little more background she provides. She says he quit his job a little more than a year before he disappeared. He wanted to see if he could sell his inventions and do what he called cowboy interior design for homes. He bought his first home 5 years ago and had an amazing ability of decorating in this style. He was not successful in getting a business going and was running out of the money after a year of not working. He no longer wanted to work in a quote-unquote job for someone else, and as his money decreased, he became more and more depressed. He really did not look for another job. In early October, with seeing his depression increase, I said to him, "You aren't going to pull a Robin Williams on me, are you?" This is when he opened up more about his depression and his thoughts, much of his life, and also about suicide. His father committed suicide when Kenny was in his early 20s. When I asked him the question, he answered me with, "If I decide to do it, you will be okay because you are good at the law of allowing." He asked me what I would think of him if he did it. He also said, "If he decided to do it, no one will ever find me. It would be easy to do something like this in the desert with the number of natural caves and mines. He could hike many miles in a day, so there's no telling where or how far he could have hiked during his 3-day two-night solo hike. When he did not call me after the third day of being gone, I called missing persons. The search for him was started within a couple of days of my call. Over 30 search and rescue team members searched 3 different times on foot. One helicopter flew over and was done, and there was no trace of Kenny or any of his camping things. They found his car in the area I told them it would be. They did find his cell phone by the mine shaft in the video. The mine shaft was only about a 4-hour hike from his car. It's my feeling that he left it behind so that he could not be tracked from the GPS in it. He also did not take the video camera with him on his solo hike. It was left in his home, so he had no intention of filming anything. Now, I share this with you for 2 reasons. First, so that you have more of an understanding of who Kenny was and to bring some peace or understanding to the situation. But secondly, if any of you do decide to go out into our desert to look for him or the M-shaped cave, be careful and bring enough water and food. Walking sticks, probably they're going to be a good idea, especially you don't want to go out and do a solo hike. Bring a GPS. Make sure that you have let family and friends know that you're heading out for this hike and when and where you're going to be returning. A search really can't be done in just one day. You would be repeating much of the same hike, just getting up the mountain, and then you'd be left with not many hours in the day to do the search. So she goes on to talk about all that and says, "Enjoy your adventures of life, and thank you for the kind, loving comments sent my way. Much love, Sharon." So Rick, again, sends that long. Thank you very much. Again, I wonder if it couldn't be the case with some of these other missing person reports, where it seems that something so strange is underway, and it seems impossible to explain where someone could have gone. And if only we had that little window into the lives of those individuals, would we not know more about what may actually be happening behind the scenes? I would say that probably the Kenny Veach story is one for the books, but my own experience digging into these kinds of missing person cases, despite some of the literature out there that says to the contrary, the causes of those disappearances probably are more down to earth. Maybe that's what happened with Kenny. Rest his soul. We'll pick it up here on the other side. It is the Graylian Report. Winding down here in the heart of the Lone Star State, I'm Micah Hanks with Cam Hale, sitting in with us here tonight on the Graylian Report, broadcasting to you worldwide around the globe at KGRAradio.com. Glad to be with you as always, your light in the darkness from the confusion that surrounds the unexplained. You know, Cam and I were just talking off the microphone. I think sometimes that there's... Actually, you said it better, so I'm going to paraphrase you, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, Cam. You were talking about the way that you enjoy the folklore about all this, but that sometimes the folklore kind of gets so far away from the likely reality of the kinds of things that we're trying to address. Mm-hmm. And this is something, I got to be honest, a lot of people write to me and they say, you know, Micah, your show and Expanded Perspectives and a couple of others are the only podcasts that I really regularly enjoy listening to. And the reason why is because you guys do try to take a more common sense approach to these kind of things. You don't jump to the most absurd conclusion about something unexplained and run with that. You can't, although many do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that while a podcast, again, is to be entertaining, and I think that truly, as, again, feedback from the listeners seems to indicate that storytelling is a big part of this, too. I've even been accused by people in the past of just someone who just... You know, you want these things to be mysteries so that you'll have something to talk about. No. Trust me, if you know me at all, you'll know that I can find something to talk about.
Boy, ain't that the truth.
Yeah, so I don't need mysteries. In fact, if anything, on this program, we try to offer a more logical perspective on things, as you guys do, whether mm-hmm. or not it's an expanded one. You know, and although it tends to be with you guys. And right. That's the thing. So I appreciate what you were saying there, Cam, about, you know, while you appreciate the folklore. Again, you know, I could paraphrase it all night, but why don't you just say it again?
Well, I appreciate the folklore in this thing, but I believe that sometimes it is they build stories. When I say they, of course, it's all encompassing. Let's just anything, not out of a malicious intent.
Right.
But that it's built. Something that gets carried away. This is a story that could easily, without her coming forward and saying this, I haven't seen anywhere where it's saying that you're not the girlfriend, you're just throwing your two cents in some strange woman. Nobody said anything like that.
Yeah.
It appears that this was the girlfriend of Mr. Veach. You see these things so easily if she wouldn't have come forward, if she would have just tried to distance herself from it, from the pain that she was going through, from losing a close person that she cared so much about. This could easily have turned into a story where it could have grown immensely to where there's this hidden M cave in the desert and that it's claimed the life of the first person that went back out to find it. It could have easily grown. And I think there's a lot of missing person cases. We've covered some. You've covered some. You and I have discussed some stuff mm-hmm. that has been done that same way, that maybe they didn't mean intentionally to mislead people or to build off the top of a tragedy, but that it kind of the folklore grew on its own. It's almost like it got legs on its own and kind of grew. And then nobody really cared to dig back into those stories without any real depth. And yeah. any, it just kind of took it and ran with it. the one thing we try to do on our show, and the same that you do, is you try to give both sides of the story. You want the listener to make up their own mind. I'll try to give you the history. I'll try to give you the very esoteric side, and then I'll give you the common, basically coming from just the common everyday guy side of it, to let's just look at what it really would be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that doesn't, you know, for instance, when it comes to these missing person cases, I think that, to address the elephant in the white room, or the white elephant in the, that was almost a Cream song.
Yeah, right. In the white room.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. Yes, but the white elephant in the room, that was great.
Beers.
Yes, please bring on the Guinness.
Yeah. Let's not get too deep in this. We'll get too carried away. We got to talk about JFK.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, but I do want to say, I met David Pilates a couple of years ago at the Fort Fest in Maryland, and I found him to be a really wonderful person, and he's even linked to a couple of my own articles about disappearances and things like that. And one thing I really respect about David is that although I think that actually many say that he presents far out theories, really all he says in his books, if you've read them, is that you need to kind of be open to, how does he term this? He says, keep your mind open to unconventional interpretations mm-hmm. of what may be going on. But he also is very careful not to tie Bigfoot in with all this stuff, having had a background in that kind of a thing. I kind of see David in a lot of ways like me, someone who was really knee deep into research into weird stuff, and then really kind of realized that he needed to kind of break from that so that he could go in a direction that in many ways, I think, with his research into missing persons, is more meaningful, and I think is more warranted, I think, as well, technologically, intellectually, and whatever, as we're, you know, heading forth. Now, some people will disagree and say that he still posits or presents information in a way that could be interpreted as being much more, again, coming back to the mountain versus the molehill argument. I mean, you know, there's much more inferred than there really probably is. Well, of course, that's the case. But again, I think that the ambiguity says more than to try and speculate about some bizarreness like, you know, UFO abductions and things. And yet, by the same token, David is open-minded enough to, at times, and he's done this, he'll reference a MUFON report if there is a record of disappearances that may have occurred in an area like that, or if there's a record of UFO sightings in that area. Again, let's say UFOs, let's be crazy. I'm going to put forward a conspiracy theory, and I'm going to tell you I'm about to do it and distinguish this from being any kind of factual discussion. This is pure, unbridled speculation. Okay, we're going to leave skepticism at the door for a moment, and we're going to move forward with a purely hypothetical for the sake of discussion. So if anybody wants to try and quote me out of context, I've given you the trigger warning, as it were. And I've made Cam snort.
Here we go.
Yeah. So here's the deal, okay? Let's say that the government, the secret government, is operating some sort of a bizarre, MyLab, conspiratorial, secret aviation program, which they utilize these aircraft for purpose of abducting members of the public, okay? In other words, I'm not saying it's aliens. But what is happening is, in this realm of speculation in which we're right now existing, you know, we should add like the sound effects so that people know that we're just imagining things right now. No. Again, in this circumstance, what if it were the case that people who claimed that they had vanished for a few days and had very little recollection of what had happened, but they'd been out there in a national forest? What if, by virtue of the speculative realm and the hypothetical that we presented within it, With regard to a secret aviation program and these aircraft that are used for purpose of capturing people and doing tests or whatever, you know, MyLab type stuff. What if that were to be found to be true, that it, again, would be a plausible earthly, you know, terrestrial kind of a component that would present a reasonable case for people who say that they've experienced strange things like missing time and disappearances and whatnot, and data collected on UFOs seen in that area? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. To say that there is something weird going on, and again, I don't really think what we just put forward. I was trying to get weird and conspiratorial and draw from conspiratorial literature in what I was describing there for obvious, you know, reasons, both for hilarious reasons as well as for the speculation which we've engaged in. But we turn off the speculation button now. I say merely that, you know, we don't have to be able to say that aliens are visiting Earth to acknowledge that there may be some importance to something like a MUFON report, which David Pilates tries to do. And he does his best, I think, to try and allow for in an open-minded spirit without disenfranchising people with his skepticism. So the missing 411 books, they don't appeal to everybody, but I find them interesting. I find them important, culturally and otherwise. And I do appreciate his work. I don't agree with him all the time on all his conclusions. Again, I do again, I'm far more on the side of skepticism when it comes to these kind of things. And I think that there are more likely mundane explanations to these kinds of things. But I do think that there's still merit to the study. And I think that we have to look at these missing person cases, because when they seem strange, there is always the possibility that however mundane the explanation yet to arrive may end up being, there still is always that possibility that strange circumstances require unique or unconventional thinking in order to solve the case. So, anyway, that said, we're going to wrap things up here talking about JFK. So it was my first time making it out there to the Dallas Motorcade. And arrived, of course, traveling en route with Joshua Cutchin and, of course, our very own beloved Kyle Filson. He was driving us out there and everything. Took off work just to come out and hang out with us. Red Pill Junkie, Newvie, a.k.a. Carol, Tim Banal, Greg Bishop, a lot of people actually who are already there. And we get out there and we're hanging out. And Steve Ray, the fellow who put on the little gathering, had already stepped across the way and he was buying the tickets for the tour. Tina Cena was there. I mean, a few people actually who I've wanted to meet for quite a while. And so as we're all kind of hanging out and talking, I was taking in the first thing, which is the size of the area. You see the stills from the Zapruder film.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get down there, it's incredible because the location looks so much today like it did. And it seems obvious that they've actually tried to maintain that presence. I think they want it to look just like it did when Kennedy was shot. The little fence up there on mm-hmm. the grassy knoll, everything. I mean, it's incredible how much today it still resembles what you see in the Zapruder film. But it's the entire area, including, I would say, the distance from the book repository window to the actual spot on the concrete where the X is marked. It's much smaller, much shorter than one would think.
Yeah, the video kind of makes you think it's a much larger. You're led to believe that it's a much longer shot, a much more difficult shot. Everything is really large and expansive. It's not. When you get there, you look at it, you're like, oh, wait, I think I could have made that shot.
Well, what I the immediate takeaway I had was, again, up there in the window. And they've got a glass paneling on the sixth floor museum where you can walk through the actual building. I mean, this is, however you look at this, however conspiratorial your mindset is, this is history.
Mm-hmm.
You are walking through history. I mean, talk about time travel. I really felt like I was time traveling. I mean, I got chills walking through that building, Cam. I mean, walking through that place. My God, and just seeing all the photographs.
You kind of got to be prepared for it. If you're not prepared for it, you go in it lighthearted, which is what most of you go in it lighthearted. You don't realize it's one of those things like we were just discussing with these missing people.
Yeah.
You kind of get numb to it because you're caught up in the conspiracy till you forget about the fact that a man and woman mm-hmm. who loved one another, who were married, who had children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He had his infidelities, but she loved him very much. And she sat beside him the day his brains were blown out on national television.
Very literally.
Yes.
I'll never forget, by the way, Cam, the first time I saw the Zapruder film, I was in probably middle school or early high school. I knew about it, but it had never really quite struck me what happened. And I was watching a documentary with my father late one night, and the moment where I remember, this is a terrible analogy, but it's, I think, the most fitting because this is exactly what I thought about. You remember the comedian Gallagher,
mm-hmm.
and he'd come out with a sledgehammer and he would bust a watermelon and just, you'd see the pink pieces.
I know where you're going with this.
Bam. And I remember the moment that I actually saw the famous shot back and to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
Absolutely horrifying.
But you become numb to it.
I think.
Because you get caught up in the conspiracy angle of this.
Well, but you know, there's more to it than that too. I think since those tender years, when I was in middle school and high school, you know, I mean, the violent video games, the violent films, yeah. you know, the general inundated society in which we exist within, in which violence has, you know, come to reign supreme. And we wonder why we've got gun problems in this country. You know, we won't go down that road. I know what happens when we do, but I mean, you can't avoid the fact that, you know, we have serious issues with violence in this country. And I think that the issues that we have stem from a culture of that. And really, again, even though I say so much has changed in just the last 10 years or so, going back again to 1963, traveling back in time to that moment, seeing what happened there, living through that experience vicariously through the photographs and through the audio recordings and the testimonies of those who were actually there, it was like, and I hadn't felt this way in so long, but it was like that first time I saw the Zapruder film and I realized, my God, I just watched a man, an American elected president. And I watched him being killed on camera.
Mm-hmm.
Unbeknownst to Mr. Zapruder as the film was rolling in. And I do wonder, there are interesting things that remain about this case. We obviously do not have all the answers. Many would try to say that we do. And I frankly don't like this idea of, well, nothing to see here, move along. What we don't know, we'll fill in the gaps, you know, with speculation. It's this attitude that in order to be able to come to terms with that which we don't know, it's okay as long as what speculation we lend to this doesn't seem crazy. And Richard Dolan and many others have pointed out over the years that, you know, it seems that since the Kennedy assassination, this was the death of innocence in America. The only thing that even comes close to that in modern times, again, an incident of equal, if not greater, magnitude in terms of the lives affected by it, but 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
9/11. But, you know, the Kennedy assassination was the moment where many of us were going, what the hell is really going on? And it was not considered a crazy idea at that time that there might have been a conspiracy, by definition. By definition, a conspiracy. Two or more individuals acting together to carry out, well, in this instance, the assassination of the United States president.
Mm-hmm.
Never since, nor probably before, excepting, of course, maybe the assassination of other presidents like Kennedy. Never sent. I would actually say, though, at that point, though, in 1963, with the proliferation of media, it was enough so, not to the degree that it is today, but it was enough so at that time that what people felt, what they saw as they gathered around the little glowing box in their living rooms, or they hovered around their radios. I remember my mom talking about, you know, we were sent home from school that day and we were all crying. Why? Because the spread of information, communication, technology was enough such that many people knew about it within a very few minutes of the actual killing shot being fired. I would argue that because of the circumstances and the time at which it happened, never has there been, nor was there ever prior to that point, ever a darker day and a point in American history during which United States citizens ever felt so completely and utterly vulnerable. It is the height of vulnerability when the head shot that is taken takes out the head of state. And you realize, my God, we all actually are that vulnerable in the blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And it can all be over. And I'm walking through that museum, and I'm looking at the photographs of Kennedy and of Jackie and of the family, of Lyndon B. Johnson. Lyndon wouldn't leave for Washington without Mrs. Kennedy, and she wouldn't leave the body of her husband, who they tried to resuscitate at the hospital and who could not be brought back to life. And you look at those photos, and you know why.
Oh, yeah.
Utter horror. Utter horror. And I tell you, it really hit me. It really hit me. And then I walk over to the window, as close as I can get to the glass that's actually blocking off the window where, according to the official narrative, Lee Harvey Oswald would have been perched, where he took the shot. And I'm standing there thinking, my God. You know, in the whole speculative realm of time travel, you know, there are certain ideas that philosophically time doesn't actually exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just, all things just are, and that time, apart from the idea of, you know, the warpage of space-time, which is what physicists call time, there are certain thinkers and philosophers over the years who have suspected that maybe time is completely illusory, and that we merely use the notion of time as a way to keep track of, okay, where will I be tomorrow? Where was I yesterday? What time today do I need to be someplace? But really, all there is really is what there is right now. Here it is, and here we are. And in that moment, I could almost feel in the stillness of the space between me and the window adjacent to me that I was there in that moment and that nothing has really changed. They have intentionally, in fact, they have preserved the floor space on that corner of that level of the building. And you can see the scuff marks that were in the floor at the time that the assassination occurred. Nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm.
The marks on the brick wall, the boxes stacked around the window. It's incredible. I mean, it is truly, truly incredible. And it gave me chills. But my immediate takeaway was, you know, he was not that far away from the location. And what he'd obviously intended was, of course, as that car passed through the intersection leading down toward the grassy knoll, he would have been directly above. That would have been an easy shot. We can imagine in our minds, let's say that Oswald's actually up there and he takes that shot. I mean, he would have been so close, but if you were in that position and you were actually going to shoot the president, I mean, my God, imagine the nerves, the tension that you're feeling. I'm sure he hesitated. And yet, had he been so nervous that he hadn't actually managed to get off the shot. He must have been calm and collected enough to have actually achieved that, unless we, of course, buy one of these alternative theories.
Now, and that's where we go with it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think many people do. It's hard to say. There have been so many ideas that have been offered over the years. You know, just to name a few of them here, Kim. The magic bullet, of course, has one of been, and it's addressed all throughout the Sixth Floor mm-hmm. Museum. Oswald fired just 3 bullets in Dallas, but he killed JFK and badly wounded Governor John Connally, who, of course, was sitting in the front seat of the limousine. By the way, I should point out, and this is the eeriest thing that happened. Before we went up into the museum, we're standing down there on the grassy knoll, and somebody says, "Look!" And I turn around, and this limousine goes driving by.
That's pretty cool.
An exact replica. There's a guy who gives tours.
In the limousine?
If not a very similar... It's it very well may be identical. I mean, it looked just like the limousine that Connally and the Kennedys were riding in, and it drives down, and I turned around in time just to snap a picture. I mean, just in enough time. I actually got a picture of that, and I was like, I'm not sure if that's really bad taste or just really incredible. So, you know, anyway, there's the magic bullet theory, which tries to account for how much damage was done with just 3 rounds. You know, there's the whole conspiracy theory involving the grassy knoll, which having actually stood there, again, once again, it really put things in a very different perspective. What struck me about that was that the little fence is still there. You know, there was a guy who was selling books, one of the authors of the conspiracy literature, and he had this great big blown up photograph, a lot of them actually, but one that showed an NBC still from footage that collected the apparent presence of a puff of smoke right up there above the fence. From the grassy knoll. I'd never seen that. I thought that was interesting. Of course, there's the idea that the CIA was involved, the Mafia, the KGB, Lyndon B. Johnson himself. Little Green Men. Yeah, last week when we talked about presidential UFOs, we did discuss that memorandum where Kennedy talked about the knowns and the unknowns in outer space. Everybody's talked about, of course, the Illuminati. The pillbox in the hat of Jackie Kennedy. Oh, come on. People have tried to say that there's a driver clearly that can be seen turning around. Oh, give me a break. You know, some of this stuff, it just goes. There have been people who have tried to say friendly fire. Yeah, just about anything that you can possibly imagine has been espoused as it relates to the Kennedy assassination. What do we really have? What's our takeaway? Well, it was the darkest day in American history. And if there are indeed conspiracies, if there are indeed inside jobs, and I think that history shows there is precedent which has revealed that there is and have been, and no doubt will continue to be, in some instances, secret dealings and things that are carried out without the best intentions with regard to the public in mind. Whatever the case may be about what happened on that day in Dallas, it was the entry into a different way of thinking for the American people who were left at their most vulnerable. That'll be the final word this week on the Grayling Report. Cam Hale, thank you so much, Brud, for being here with me.
It was a great time, brother. Thank you for having me on.
Always incredible. And to all of you guys out there in Gradioland, thank you so much. On behalf of all of us here at Grayling International, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, John Anderson, Racing Robin Hobbs, and of course, yours truly. I remain Micah Hanks, the Doctor of the Dark Heart of the Hollow Earth, here looking up at the Texas skies for the next week or so. We'll catch you guys again next week on the Grayling Report. I bid you adieu, and as always, stay strange.
You've been listening to The Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grayling Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, graylingreport.com.